Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Mario Ritter Jr., and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
A new study says that a change in health recommendations might lead to lower cholesterol levels and more treatment for people with high levels of heart disease risk. Dr. Pankaj Arora of the University of Alabama at Birmingham led the study. "The news is very heartening," Arora said, "but there is more to do. Heart disease is the world's leading killer, and high cholesterol is a key risk factor. Doctors have long treated patients based mostly on their level of so-called bad cholesterol, known as LDL. In 2013, new guidelines in the United States urged doctors to examine people's overall heart risk. In other words, the guidelines recommended that doctors consider age, blood pressure, diabetes, and other factors. The idea was that people with the highest risk would get the most benefit from cholesterol-lowering medications called statins. The researchers studied records from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. These records tracked cholesterol information from more than 32,000 adults between 2005 and 2016. Among people taking statins, the average level of bad cholesterol dropped 21 points over the study period. Total cholesterol levels and another kind of fat in the blood also decreased. The researchers reported their findings in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. Dr. Michael Miller is a heart disease expert at the University of Maryland Medical Center. He was not involved with the study. Miller said, "These are surprisingly impressive results that together predict a 15-20% reduction in risk of heart attacks and strokes." In addition, there was an increase in statin use by people with diabetes. Over the study period, that number increased from less than half to over 60%. It's very important for those with a diagnosis of diabetes to not get that first heart attack, said Dr. Neil J. Stone of Northwestern University. Stone led the development of the 2013 guidelines from the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association. He also co-wrote an update last year. Dr. Arora warned that other high-risk groups have not seen an increase in treatment. He added that still too many people do not know if they have a cholesterol problem. The advice for patients? Dr. Miller suggested getting a cholesterol check if you have not had one recently. I'm John Russell.
A 23-year-old British woman has invented a product she hopes will one day replace single-use plastic. The new product is made by combining fishing waste and algae. It could be used to replace plastic bags or containers that people use once and throw away. Lucy Hughes created the material called Marinatex for her final year project at the University of Sussex. The Reuters news agency says she continued her research after she left the university. On November 13th, the James Dyson Foundation announced that Hughes was the international winner of the 2019 James Dyson Award for Design. Marinatex is edible, meaning it can be eaten without danger. Hughes says it also is strong and stable. But unlike plastic, Marinatex biodegrades in 4 to 6 weeks under normal conditions and does not pollute the soil. The inventor said she is concerned about the growing amounts of plastics in ocean waters. She noted one report that there would be more plastic than fish in the world's oceans by the year 2050. The United Nations estimates that 100 million tons of plastic waste has already been left in the oceans. Hughes also was investigating ways to reduce the amount of waste from the fishing industry. The industry produces an estimated 50 million tons of waste worldwide each year, UN officials say. Hughes told Reuters that she was trying to work out how I could use the waste stream and add value to that waste. Examining fish parts left over from processing helped to give her the idea for a material that was useful and did not harm the environment. Why do we need to have hundreds of man-made polymers when nature has so many already available? She asked. To create a strong material, Hughes added the molecule chitosan, which comes from sea creatures like crabs, and agar, a substance from red algae. After months of testing, Hughes produced a strong, flexible sheet that forms at temperatures below 100 degrees Celsius. Inventor James Dyson said that Marinatex is stronger, safer, and much more sustainable than the plastic polyethylene. It is also easier to break down or compost than other possible replacement products for polyethylene, the material that single-use plastic bags are made of. Hughes will receive about $41,000 in prize money as the first place winner of the James Dyson Award. She told Reuters that she plans to use the money to further develop the product and ways to mass produce it. Further research and development will ensure that Marinatex evolves further and becomes part of a global answer to the abundance of single-use plastic waste, Dyson said. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
new study suggests that dog training methods based on negative punishments can cause long-term harm to the animal. Much research in the past has studied training methods in general, including for dogs working with police or with search and rescue operations. But the latest study centered on dogs kept as companion animals for humans. Such dogs are often considered part of the family and need training on how to behave around people. Researchers from Portugal's University of Porto led the study. The researchers carried out experiments involving two kinds of dog training methods, aversive and reward-based. Aversive methods depend on the use of some kind of negative action in answer to unwanted behaviors. Examples of this include shouting, pushing, or pulling the dog to force it to do something, or using special collars that put pressure on the neck. Reward-based methods involve giving the dog food, praise, or attention when the animal completes wanted behaviors. The study included 92 dogs that were attending training schools in Portugal. 50 of the dogs received aversive training, while 42 were trained using reward-based methods. The experiments were designed to measure both short-term and long-term effects of the two training methods. The dogs were video recorded during training sessions so researchers could observe their reactions to the training. Researchers also collected mouth fluid from the dogs before and after the training to test for levels of a stress-causing hormone called cortisol. Researchers reported that dogs from the aversive training group were observed to have more stress-related behaviors than those in the reward-based group. They also showed increased levels of cortisol. The study suggests these results clearly demonstrate the short-term effects of aversive training methods. Another part of the experiment was designed to measure the long-term effects of the two different methods. This involved the dogs taking part in an exercise about a month after the training sessions. The dogs were put in a room containing food bowls. Researchers observed how quickly and excitedly the dogs went to the bowls. The researchers reported that the dogs receiving aversive training were observed to be more pessimistic in behaviors in the room than the ones trained with rewards. The latest study supports earlier research on the effectiveness of reward-based training. Many other studies have suggested that food is the best reward to get dogs to perform the behaviors we want. One of those studies was led by Erica Fubacher, a professor at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, Virginia. Her study compared a food reward to a reward of petting or praising the animal. Fubacher told the Associated Press the dogs were clear about what reward they liked better. "They'll work harder and respond faster for food than for social interaction," she said. Fubacher noted, for example, that research has found that dogs were likely to stay near a person praising them for the same amount of time as if they were being ignored. Zazie Todd is the writer of a forthcoming book called WAG, The Science of Making Your Dog Happy. She told the AP that people clearly should not expect a dog to obey just because they love them. If only it was like that, she said. Todd added, if your boss stopped paying you, you'd probably stop going to work pretty quickly. You need to motivate your dog, too. Some dog trainers teach the use of life rewards, which could include play or taking the dog for a walk. Todd says these can be useful, especially to help keep behaviors the dog has already learned. However, for most everyday behaviors most people want to teach, food rewards are just quicker and easier, she said. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In October of 1859, a group of anti-slavery extremists attacked the town of Harper's Ferry. Harper's Ferry was part of Virginia then. Today, it is located in West Virginia. The attackers were led by John Brown. They seized a gun factory and a federal supply center where military equipment was kept. They planned to use the guns and equipment to organize a rebel army of slaves. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell us what happened to John Brown after he seized Harper's Ferry.
The President of the United States in 1859 was James Buchanan. When Buchanan learned of the attack, he wanted immediate action. He sent a force of Marines to Harper's Ferry under the command of Army Colonel Robert E. Lee. John Brown had attacked with about 20 men. Several, including two of his sons, had been killed by local militia. He and his remaining men withdrew to a small brick building. The attack had failed. Not one slave had come to Harper's Ferry to help Brown. The few whom his men had freed had refused to fight when the shooting started. Brown could not understand the fear that kept the slaves from fighting for their freedom.
Brown and his men were trapped inside the brick building. They held a few hostages whom they hoped to exchange for their freedom. Colonel Lee wrote a message to John Brown demanding his surrender. He did not think Brown would surrender peaceably, so he planned to attack as soon as Brown rejected the message. He felt this was the surest way to save the lives of the hostages. As expected, Brown refused to surrender. He said he and his men had the right to go free. As soon as Brown spoke, the signal was given. The Marines attacked. They broke open a small hole in the door of the brick building. One by one, the Marines moved through the hole. They fought hand to hand against the men inside. After a brief fight, they won. John Brown's rebellion was crushed.
A few hours after Brown was captured, the governor of Virginia and three congressmen arrived in Harper's Ferry. They wanted to question Brown. Brown had been wounded in the final attack. He was weak from the loss of blood, but he welcomed the chance to explain his actions. The officials first asked where Brown got the money to organize his raid. Brown said he raised most of it himself. He refused to give the names of any of his supporters. Then the officials asked why Brown had come to Harper's Ferry. "We came to free the slaves," Brown said, "and only that." He continued, "I think that you are guilty of a great wrong against God and humanity. I believe anyone would be perfectly right to interfere with you so far as to free those you wickedly hold in slavery. I think I did right. You had better, all you people of the South, prepare yourselves for a settlement sooner than you are prepared for it. You may get rid of me very easily. I am nearly gone now. But this question is still to be settled. This Negro question, I mean. That is not yet ended."
The raid on Harper's Ferry increased the bitterness of the national dispute over slavery. Members of the Democratic Party called the raid a plot by the Republican Party. Republican leaders denied the charge. They said the raid was the work of one man, one madman, John Brown. Still, they said, he had acted for good reason, to end slavery in America. Southern newspapers condemned Brown. Some said his raid was an act of war. Some demanded that he be executed as a thief and murderer. Many Southerners said all of the North was responsible for the raid. They believed all Northerners wanted a slave rebellion in the South. And it was such a rebellion that Southerners feared more than anything else. New measures were approved throughout the South to prevent this. Military law was declared in some areas. Slave owners threatened to beat or hang any Negro who even looked rebellious.
The fear of a slave rebellion united the people of the South. For years, rich slave owners had talked of taking the Southern states out of the Union to save their way of life. But those who had no slaves opposed the idea of disunion. John Brown's raid changed that. After his attack on Harper's Ferry, the South spoke with one voice. All Southerners declared that they would fight to protect their homes from a Negro rebellion or from another attack by men like Brown. Feelings were especially high in Virginia, the state in which the raid took place. Virginians wanted Brown punished quickly to show what would happen to anyone who tried to lead a Negro rebellion. There was some question whether Brown should be tried in a federal court or a state court. Brown's raid took place within the borders of a state, but the property he seized belonged to the federal government. The governor of Virginia decided to try Brown in a state court. He believed a federal court trial would take too long. If Brown were not brought to trial quickly, he said, people might attack the jail and kill him.
Brown was being held in Charlestown, a few kilometers from Harper's Ferry. The court there named two lawyers to defend him. A doctor examined Brown. He reported that Brown's wounds were not serious enough to prevent the trial from starting. Brown lay in a bed in the courtroom throughout the trial. John Brown's lawyers tried to show that his family had a history of madness. They tried to prove that Brown, too, was mad. They asked the court to declare him innocent because of insanity. Brown protested. He said the lawyers were just trying to save his life. He did not want such a defense. The matter of insanity was dropped.
Brown's lawyers then argued that he was not guilty of the three crimes with which he was charged. First, they said, he could not be guilty of treason against Virginia because he was not a citizen of Virginia. Second, he could not be guilty of plotting a slave rebellion because he had never incited slaves against their owners. And third, he could not be guilty of murder because he had killed only in self-defense. The trial lasted 5 days. The jury found John Brown guilty of all three charges.
The judge asked Brown if he wanted to make a statement before being sentenced. Brown did. He declared that he had not planned to start a slave rebellion. He said he only wanted to free some slaves and take them to Canada. Brown's statement was strong, but it was not true. He had, in fact, planned to organize an army of slaves to fight for their freedom. He acted in the belief that slaves throughout the South would rise up against their owners and join him. Brown's words did not move the judge. He said he could find no reason to question the jury's decision that Brown was guilty. He sentenced Brown to be hanged.
One of Brown's supporters attempted to find a way to free Brown from jail. Several plans were proposed. None were tried. Brown himself did not want to escape. He said he could do more to destroy slavery by hanging than by staying alive. John Brown was executed on December 2nd, 1859. His death created a wave of public emotion throughout the country. In the North, people mourned. One man wrote, "The events of the last month or two have done more to build Northern opposition to slavery than anything which has ever happened before, than all the anti-slavery pamphlets and books that have ever been written." In the South, people cheered, but their happiness at Brown's punishment was mixed with anger at those who honored him. As the nation prepared for a presidential election year, the South renewed its promise to defend slavery or leave the Union.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.